This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Preborn. For $140, you can provide ultrasounds to five women in crisis pregnancies. Call now, 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229, or visit preborn.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Welcome. Thank you so much for being with us again. It is very important for us as Americans to recall our heritage, and that is especially vital as so many of us are losing our grip on the truth about our forefathers whose sacrifices were necessary in order to secure our freedoms. So as we celebrate this nation's independence and the adoption of our Declaration of Independence back in 1776, we are going to be taking a look back at the founders' fight for freedom with Dr. William J. Federer. He is a nationally known speaker and best-selling author, president of Amerisearch Incorporated, and host of the American Minute radio feature. And Bill, it's wonderful to have you here. How are you?
Janet, great to be with you.
Thank you. I would ask you a question before we dive into the history. What would you say July 4th means to you as an American, just on a personal level?
Well, it's the difference between the word citizen and subject. Kings have subjects who are subjected to their will. The word citizen is Greek, and it means a co-ruler, a co-regent, a co-king. And so we pledge allegiance to the flag and to the republic. We're basically pledging allegiance to us being in charge of ourselves. We're all citizens. We run the republic. We're all co-kings. And so what we saw is a polarity change in world government from one that was ruled by kings from the beginning of Nimrod, Tower of Babel, to the people get to be in charge of our lives. And so it's a polarity change from a top down to bottom up. And it's the difference between a dead pyramid and a living tree where every root and every little capillary root sucks in nutrients to help keep the thing alive. Every citizen participates in making this thing work.
Right.
And so, again, a democracy is where the citizens rule directly, and it only ever worked on a citywide level where everyone could be at the market every day to talk politics. If you didn't show up for a couple of days, you're called an idiot, because you don't know what's going on. A republic is where you take care of your family and your farm, and you have someone in your place that goes to the market every day and talks politics. They're your representative. And so we have a representative. The word REP in the republic is the same REP in representative. So a republican government is a representative form of government. So we, the people, are the king ruling through representatives. And we pledge allegiance to the flag and to the republic. We're pledging allegiance to us being in charge of ourselves.
Yes, absolutely.
And so when
right.
somebody protests the flag, what they're saying is, I don't want to be the king anymore. I protest this system where I participate in ruling. It's like, okay, somebody else will dictate what's going to happen in your life.
Right.
But what I see the 4th of July is this polarity change. Instead of being ruled by kings, we cut the umbilical cord, and we, the people, are the king.
I love that. And that's such a great explanation of the great country that we've been given, and it's been handed down to us. But as you mentioned, there are some great people in history to whom we owe an enormous debt. And it doesn't just start with the founders. You go back to the Pilgrims. Obviously, when we look at what the Pilgrims went through, without them, we wouldn't have a United States of America either. What do you think people ought to know about the Pilgrims and their quest for religious freedom and how that played into our freedom today?
Well, it's pretty critical. One of the books I wrote called Who Was the King in America, I literally go back to the beginning of the invention of writing, Sumerian cuneiform on clay tablets in the Mesopotamian Valley around 3300 BC. And so from the beginning of human record keeping, the most common form of government is a king. Nimrod, Tower of Babel, Egyptian pharaohs, Cyrus of Persia, Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar. And as the centuries go on, the kingdoms get bigger. Because with military and technological advancements, you can kill more people.
Right.
The phalanx, those long spears, the stirrups, the scimitar sword, the gunpowder. It's the same spirit of Cain killing Abel. St. Augustine called it libido dominandi, the lust to dominate. So you put some babies in a playpen, one takes the rattle from the others. You put some kids on a playground, one's the bully hogging the ball. You put some junior high girls in a clique, and one of them is the diva. You put some people in the woods, one of them's the Indian chief, and you put them in an inner city, one of them is a gang leader. And all a king is a glorified gang leader. And it's a hierarchical system. If you are friends with the king, you are more equal. If you are not friends with the kings, you are less equal. And if you're an enemy of the king, you're dead. It's called treason, or you're a slave. And so it's this pyramid structure to society that keeps repeating itself all around the globe. And as the centuries go on, from Nimrod, Tower of Babel, they keep getting bigger and bigger. Clearly, there's a global goal in mind. But by the time the founding fathers come along, the king of England was the most powerful king on the planet. He controlled 13 million square miles, a half a billion people, all of India, a quarter of the world's population right there, Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, British Guiana, Canada, and America. The king of England was a globalist, and our founder said, we don't like this globalist king telling us what to do, and so they flipped it. Now, we use the pilgrims. Why? Because that's where the polarity change began. The kings controlled the world through their colonies, and there were three type of colonies, company colonies, where the some rich guys go to the king, and they say, hey, give us some monopoly on doing trade, and the king does, and but the king's in charge. Well, the Virginia Company went bankrupt, and so the king sent over a royal crown governor who ruled it, the colony, directly. Third type is a proprietary colony, where the king gives the whole thing to a friend, like Lord Baltimore got all of Maryland, William Penn got all of Pennsylvania. Well, Jamestown, the first English colony in America, the king ruled it. And so the pilgrims were going, they fled England to Holland because they were separatists. They weren't Anglicans.
Right.
And the king had the Star Chamber, where if you were had some people meeting in your home talking religion without approval of the government, they would bust in the door and arrest everybody as criminals. You're believing something other than what the government tells you to believe. If you're preaching within 5 miles of a town and you don't have approval of the government, it's like cake bakers, right? The government comes and arrests you for not believing what the government tells you to believe. And so you have to go before the Star Chamber, and there's no lawyers. They'll twist your arm and cut off your nose if you don't believe what the king does. So the pilgrims fled England, went to Holland. When Spain threatened to attack Holland, they fled again, and they were going to go to Jamestown. And this is where the miracle takes place. They get blown off course 500 miles. You say, that's a miracle? Yeah. They land in Massachusetts. They try going south around Cape Cod. It's called the graveyard of ships because 3,000 ships have sunk on that area of Cape Cod because the shoals, the sand goes way out into the ocean. It keeps shifting, and the ships, anyway, the pilgrims almost sink. And the captain says, too dangerous to sail. He goes back to Cape Cod and to Plymouth Rock and says, pilgrims, everybody off the boat. And it's like the pilgrims raise their hand and they say, well, who's going to be in charge of us? There's no king-appointed person in our group. And they do something unique. They give themselves the authority to start a government.
Right.
It's called the Mayflower Compact. The word compact means covenant. And so it's we, in the presence of God, covenant ourselves together to form a civil body politic. This was revolutionary. It's the beginning of a body, in the little womb, or the little hull of this Mayflower, is this little DNA change from top down to bottom up. And the thought is, where did the pilgrims get this idea that they could start a government and rule themselves from the bottom up? From their pastor, John Robinson. He was not an Anglican king-appointed pastor. He was a separatist pastor. And he was there in Holland, and it was like a big home group. And it was he was considered one of the founders of the Congregationalist Church. There's only 0.5% Congregationalist today. But back then, it was this church model where everybody in the group fasts and prays and votes. The pilgrims simply took their church model of government and made it their community model of government.
Right.
Everybody together, we all seek the Lord and we all vote. This became this change in the flow of power that spread through New England. The Congregationalists founded, New Hampshire and Connecticut, Massachusetts, and even when Roger Williams founded Rhode Island, he says the form of government is a popular government. That is to say, it is power in the hands of the people freely assembled. And so this is what we celebrate on the 4th of July. It's we, the people, get to be the kings. It's a change in the flow of power. So if you like dictators of, you can go back to Europe and but if you like being in charge of your life, our founding fathers, for all their human failings, they gave us a form of government where we get to participate in ruling ourselves.
We sure appreciate it too. Well, there's more to discuss. We'll come back with Dr. William Federer. We're talking about the 4th of July, our Declaration of Independence, and what we owe to our forefathers. We'll come back on Janet Mefford Today after this. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care, so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org, and regain control over your healthcare costs. That number again, 855-585-4237 or libertyhealthshare.org. Together, we're changing healthcare for good.
Hi, I'm Kevin Sorbo. I wanted to invite you to offer your full support for the Ministry of Preborn and its leader, Dan Steiner. The team at Preborn is very focused and very successful at saving preborn babies from abortion. Now get ready to write down the phone number and the website so you can join the Preborn team.
Join Kevin Sorbo and me, Janet Mefford, as we support Preborn. The mission at Preborn is to supply pregnancy centers throughout America with sonograms. Ultrasounds are a game changer when it comes to saving babies' lives. You see, when an abortion-minded woman sees her baby on ultrasound and hears the heartbeat, she's 80% more likely to keep her baby. For $140, you can save five babies' lives. To donate, dial #250 and say keyword baby, or donate securely at preborn.com. Your love can save a life. Call 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229.
Every baby deserves to be born. God bless.
We are back on Janet Mefford today. So glad to be talking with Dr. William J. Federer about our founding. We have so much to be grateful for on Independence Day, and we can't ever take for granted that the United States of America is incredibly unique among the nations of the world throughout human history. And we've been discussing the fact that throughout most of human history, kings have been in charge. And it was just so revolutionary when the Pilgrims came to this country and they settled and had the Mayflower Compact and were walking through history. Up to the founders. Now, Bill, this is so important. When we're reading, it's interesting when you read the Declaration of Independence, because a lot of people, I don't think, have ever read it all the way through. But what is left out when people tend to discuss it is all of the references that they make in there about the abuses of King George. And it's funny how many, many years of studying history and sitting through history courses, there wasn't a lot of intricate discussion, at least in the course of the history courses I took, about all those abuses. Why was that such an important thing to include, where they just went through the abuses one by one by one? He's doing this, he's doing this, he's doing this.
You submit to the authority as long as the authority is submitted to God. And so the Bible talks about, you know, children obeying your parents. What if the parents tell the kids to go out and sell drugs or rob or steal or sell their bodies as prostitutes? The kid does not have to obey his dad if his dad tells him to, you know, kill a neighbor, right?
Right.
So the idea was, we submit to the king as long as the king is submitted to God. And what these 28 reasons were is the king has unkinged himself by stopping submitting to God. It says how he has incited the natives on the frontiers to butcher the inhabitants of our colonies. He's made all the judges dependent on his will alone. That was one of the big deals. The colonists paid the judges, and the king said, no, I want to pay all the judges. You think, oh, sure, pay up. No, no, no. They understood that your loyalty goes to where your money's coming from.
You're right.
And now the king is just, and so they list all these different reasons, and they break away. The one line that is really politically charged is, all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. Why is that so important? The King of England did not believe all men are created equal. He believed he was created a little extra special, that kings were God's lieutenants upon earth. They were divinely appointed, and the creator gives all the power to the king, and he dispenses it as he wills. And we in America say, no, there is no special king. Everyone's equal. And the creator gives the rights and power directly to each individual person. And we sort of choose from amongst equals who's going to be in charge of fixing the potholes and defending against the Indians and running the government. But we, the people, are the ones that get the rights directly from God.
Right.
And so the king didn't like this. And, you know, when you look through world history, the kings ruled, and there were all these ways to try to limit his power. First was they limited the king through his own words. Remember that with, you know, in King of Persia, and he said, I'm not going to see Vashti again. And then they said, King, you can't change it. You said you weren't going to see her again. And they put Daniel in lion's den, and, oh, I want to let him out. No, King, you made this proclamation. You can't change it. You got to throw him in. So the king's limited by his own words. Then kings are limited by past kings' words, right? The Jews want to rebuild the temple, and the different people say, no, you can't. They send a letter, and the king does a search in the records. And sure enough, they find out where the King Cyrus said, you know, yeah, let the Jews rebuild their temple. So the king honors the past king's words. Then kings are limited by the different religious orders, because a lot of these, especially in pagan countries, they believed that their pagan god gave them the right to be the king. And so this religious order sort of confirmed that or didn't confirm it. And then the kings were limited by public opinion. Finally, in England, they were limited by 25 barons that surrounded King John on the fields of Runnymede and forced him to sign this Magna Carta, which says you can't throw anybody in jail at a whim and take away our land whenever you want. And if you pick on one of us, the other 24 are going to come after you. But in America, we said, why try to limit the king? Let's just cut the umbilical cord and not have a king.
Right.
And let's actually do this flip and make the people the king. And when you see that, if it wasn't for France, the second biggest power, giving England a run for its money, if it wasn't for a 3,000-mile ocean, and if it wasn't for us having 150 years of practicing self-government on a small colonial level. See, Europe was the chessboard, and America was sort of this bothersome backwater, and the King of England was like, you know, as long as you don't cost me money, just do whatever you want. And so we got to practice in America this little self-government. And when we finally got rid of the king, we were able to continue it. You contrast this with Iraq. We get rid of Saddam Hussein. We give them a constitution. They vote. They put their little finger in ink. In one election cycle, they vote back in Sharia law, where it's the death penalty if you leave Islam and you can beat your wife.
Yeah.
And we're scratching our heads thinking, what was wrong with the Constitution? Nothing. You just planted it in a soil that had, you know, Islamic, you know, soil. Right. They have no concept of equality. The Soviet Union falls apart. We help them set up republics and so forth. And what happens? It gets taken over by the mafia, the organized crime. And we scratch our heads thinking, what's wrong? Well, nothing. You just planted the seed in the soil that had 70 years of atheism plowed into it. And atheism says this life is all there is. Do whatever you can to get ahead. In America, we take the seed of a democratically elected constitutional republic. It's like a genetically engineered seed. And we plant it in a soil that's predominantly Christian,
right.
Judeo-Christian. Right? The statistics are 98% of the colonists were Protestant, 1% Catholic, and 0.1% Jewish. And so here we had this 150 years of this Judeo-Christian ethic pounded into the consciousness of the country. And when we finally had this freedom, it produced this harvest of individual liberties that the world has never seen before.
That's right. Well, it was interesting. I know that you've addressed this before, that the founders were willing to risk everything for their independence. And you've quoted John Hancock, for example, saying the price on my head has just doubled after he signed the Declaration and was the first one to do that. What was it like for those founders to sign that Declaration of Independence? We take it so for granted today. Well, of course, it's a great document. Of course, we want to be free. Of course, we know that rights come from God and not from government. But for those men, what did they risk by doing that?
Well, we've seen recently where you have a different government saying that you have to push the transgendered agenda or the LGBT agenda. And some people say, no, we're going to stick with Judeo-Christian values. And what happens is the different states come down upon them like a ton of bricks.
Yes.
And these people have to stand up strong. Well, imagine that. The King of England was the most powerful man on the planet, and our founders were standing up to him, saying, no, we're not going to submit to the Anglican Church as the state church. We're not going to submit to you dictating our lives, taxation without any representation. And so this was sort of like, you know, communist country standing up to a dictator. They had a tremendous amount of courage. And when you look at the prices that they paid, 11 had their homes destroyed, 5 were hunted and captured, 17 served in the military, and 9 died during the Revolutionary War. Some were young. 27-year-old George Walton signed the Declaration, and he was at the Battle of Savannah, Georgia. He was wounded and captured. Another was Edward Rutledge, 27 years old, Thomas Hayward, 30, Arthur Middleton, 34, and they were captured at the siege of Charleston and put in these British starving ships where they wouldn't feed you and thousands died. 38-year-old Thomas Nelson, the British used his home as the headquarters at the siege of Yorktown, and Nelson supposedly offered 5 guineas, which was their currency, to the first man who would shoot a cannon at his own house because he didn't want the British to use it as a headquarters. There was a 42-year-old Thomas McCain, and he was hunted like a fox by the enemy, compelled to move his family 5 times in 3 months. Richard Stockton, the city in California is named after his son, who was a commander in the Navy. But Richard Stockton was 46 years old. He was snitched on by a loyalist neighbor, and the British drag him from his bed at night, and he's thrown in jail. And then you have Abraham Clark, and 2 of his sons were tortured and imprisoned on the British starving ship Jersey. This boat they left in the New York Harbor, and they just put the Americans on them and let them starve to death. And then you had John Witherspoon, the only preacher to sign the Declaration. His son, James, was killed at the Battle of Germantown. And then there was Francis Lewis. His wife was imprisoned, and she was treated so harshly in prison, she was about to die. They let her release her, right, and she dies right after she's released. And John Hart, his home was looted, and he had to remain in hiding for months, a 65-year-old guy having to live out in the woods and in caves, and he died before the war ended. All these people paid the price so that you and I could have a say in our government, that we are all co-citizens, we're all co-kings, that we get the bottom-up form of government. And 41-year-old John Adams wrote to his wife after the Declaration was approved. He says, "I'm apt to believe that it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as a great anniversary festival. It ought to be commemorated as a day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to Almighty God. It ought to be solemnized by pomp, parade, shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires." We're really good in the second half of that, but they concentrated on the first half so much that in 1835, a French guy who was a friend of Alexis de Tocqueville, this French person, Gustave de Beaumont, traveling America, and he's in Washington, D.C. on the 4th of July, and he said, "I have seen a meeting of the Senate in Washington open with a prayer, and the anniversary festival of the Declaration of Independence consists, in the United States, of an entirely religious ceremony." So the next time we celebrate the 4th, remember that the founding fathers in that first generation, it was a religious ceremony. Why? Because they realized that out of these 6,000 years of recorded human history of a world ruled by kings and pharaohs and Caesars and Kaisers, and them getting more and more and more powerful with a global goal in mind, and our founders broke away, cut the umbilical cord, and flipped it and made we the people the king.
I love it.
Again, our founders, they gave us this form of government.
They certainly did, and it's a great Independence Day to celebrate it. William J. Federer, thank you so much, Bill, for being here. Great to have you.
Thank you, Janet.
This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Preborn. For $140, you can provide ultrasounds to 5 women in crisis pregnancies. Call now, 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-2229, or visit preborn.com. Back on Janet Mefford Today. One thing that I have learned as a mom is that none of my 4 children are the same. And you might have noticed that in your house too. Their personalities vary, their temperaments vary. But our goal for all 4 of them is that they would follow Jesus Christ all their lives as his disciples and exhibit godly character. The question is, how do you parent different children in a way that gets them to that same goal? Well, we're going to talk about it today with Hetty Britz. She is a speaker and author and a mother of 3, also developer of the Evergreen Parenting Course and co-developer of the Tall Trees Profiles, and today we'll be talking about her book, Growing Kids with Character. Hetty, great to have you with us. How are you?
for this opportunity. I am well.
Good. That's excellent. All right. Well, you talk about this issue of better preparing ourselves for parenting. And I'm curious to ask what your experience was like with preparing for parenting. Did you do a lot of it before you had children?
I don't think I did the right kind. I was that person who had the baby room prepared, and I read all of the books, and I did the antenatal classes, but I don't think I prepared my heart enough. I don't think I thought about what it would be like to raise a baby who's not like me at all. I think I was still in a selfish mode of, I'm going to get all of this information so that when this baby arrives, I can go on with my life without being phased. But, oh, my goodness, this baby phased me, and it was so good for me. It was so good to be brought to a standstill by a little person who needed me so much.
Yes, absolutely. So now, when you talk to mothers who are expecting their first children, for example, what would you say about preparing yourself for parenting and what you need to do as a Christian woman if you're expecting a baby or expect to have a baby in the next few years?
Well, we need to know that it's a brand new life that's waiting, and it's good, but that means that we need to leave certain things behind. Some of the ideas of how we were raised, and even if we were raised in a beautiful way and we had a happy household, to know that that world for which our parents raised us no longer exists, and that we need to be a student of the world that we are going to be raising our kids in, so that we can be prepared and prayerful about how to do that. And also to be ready for God to shape us while we are shaping our children. Because if we are not under his pruning shears and under his lordship, we don't actually, I believe, have the right to lord it over our children and to shape them. So it's going to be a humbling journey.
Absolutely.
That's the important word.
Yes. Oh, it's humbling for sure. It's absolutely humbling. Well, now, when you discuss the issue of allowing the Lord to prune you as a parent, how does God do that? How has God done that in your life?
Well, I think I have that that personality that thinks everybody's trying to be like me. They're just struggling. And I need to help them be like me, because obviously the way I am is the way we should be.
Right.
So what God did through my kids, and it still does through my kids, is show me that people don't need to be like me. They don't even want to be like me. They have their own strengths, and I have mine. And he works through them to help me understand I am not all they're ever going to need, and I'm not all they want to be, so that I can stop being the experiment and thinking everybody else is the control group, so that I can understand the value of the body of Christ, the other role players in my children's life. And so, again, it's a cutting back to size so that I understand that there are beautiful gifts in my children that are not in me, and vice versa.
Well, for sure. Now, when you look at your children, and you can extrapolate that out into other people's families and their children, as I said, my kids are all very different from one another. This becomes a problem for some parents, because when you have a baby, you think, well, they should all be the same. They all came from the same mom and the same dad, so they should all operate the same way. I just apply this rule, or I do this form of discipline, and presto changeo, out comes a child with godly character. Obviously, it doesn't work that way, but how do you begin to really assess the difference between your children when you have several who are not very much the same?
Well, life does it for you, and sometimes in painful ways. I mean, for the first 3 years of my daughter's life, or 2.5 years, I missed who she was completely. And I think this is what drove me to say, we have to figure this out. We have to be able to assess kids. And that's not easy. I now know, after many years of doing this with my colleagues, developing this child test, that I now know why there are no children's temperament tests in the market, because it's really hard. And we are so subjective when it comes to our kids. It's hard to see them for who they are. So you need a tool where a teacher and a spouse and a grandma and an older sibling can weigh in and say, this is what I see and this is what I see. And even the child can participate, and all of those responses together can tell us who the child is. So yes, of course, we can take the painful, longer route and figure out what works and what does not work. But sometimes by then, we have created a dent in a relationship, and we have lost precious time to bond with this child. And so this is what Growing Kids wants to prevent, the sadness and the harm to a relationship I know parents love their kids. I loved my daughter to death. I waited 6 years for her. I was so happy for her arrival, but I missed who she was anyway.
Oh, wow. How did you finally discover who she was? What was that process like for you?
Well, I took her to a therapist because I thought something was wrong with her. And the therapist had us complete something like a temperament profile about her. And afterwards told us, no, this is not who your daughter is at all. I don't think you're reading her right. Let me explain what I see. And she sent me home with a book by, I think, Florence Littauer about Personality Plus. And I read some of that, and I didn't, you know, and a whole new world opened up for me. And I thought, I want to read about this more. So many years of studying went into what is now Growing Kids with Character, but also work for 8 years in the poor part of town with traumatized kids, where, you know, you have the overlays of issues and alcoholism and abuse and incest and all those things that can just mess up kids. So I worked with those kids for 8 years, and then the research together with that, that's what culminated in this
wow.
model.
Well, now, when you talk about children as being different sorts of trees, this is a way of sort of looking at your children and analyzing their personalities and their differences. What are the trees that you use to distinguish among your children, and how to evaluate what sort of personality and what sort of child you have?
Yes, we start with four basic trees, but they can combine into four times four, you know, so many different possible combinations. So let me just say, these are not boxes, but elements. Temperament means mixture. So every child will have a unique mixture of these four basic temperament types. And I picked, for the extroverted, powerful, strong-willed child, I picked rosebush, because you have the flowers, which are symbols of being productive and getting stuff done, and the colorfulness there, but there are thorns there.
Yes.
And the parents who raise these kids will know what that means. It's the child who you think is going to cuddle in your arms, and then they bite you. It's the child who does not want to be babied, who arrives all grown up. And then the power battle is kind of permanently what it's about. So that's the kind of prickly but really strong child who makes us proud if we give them enough space to do that. And then the other extroverted child is the palm tree, and this is a very happy tree. You can just imagine the palm trees on the beach of Hawaii. That's the worldview of this child. It's fun in the sun, and if the sun isn't shining today, it definitely will tomorrow. And they're very social. And, you know, but there is some of the coconuts going on as well. They can be a little interesting and colorful, especially in the teenage years. They can be a handful. But they're so much fun to raise. And if you've ever seen a hurricane pass over those palm trees, they stand right back up. And these kids are incredibly resilient and optimistic. And then the quieter two tree types are the boxwood tree and the pine tree. Now, when you've looked at boxwoods that can be pruned into these perfectly shaped topiary trees, you know a lot about boxwood personality type already. They want to know where the boundaries are. They want to look right, be right, speak right, never get into trouble, play by the rules. And boxwood trees, wood is also used to make fine-tuning forks for instruments, musical instruments like violins. And these kids are like that. They're the fine tuners, and they are also really sensitive to when anything is out of tune or out of place.
Wow. Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a break. We'll come back to this discussion with Hetty Britz. Her book is called Growing Kids with Character, Nurturing Your Child's Potential, Purpose, and Passion. You're listening to Janet Mefford today, and we'll be right back.
When I first found out I was pregnant, I was surrounded by fear and disbelief. When I told my boyfriend at the time, he told me to get an abortion. There was no negotiation.
This is the story of a young lady who decided to keep her baby after hearing her baby's beautiful heartbeat on ultrasound. The Ministry of Preborn provides ultrasounds for pregnancy centers across America for free. When an abortion-minded woman hears her baby's heartbeat on ultrasound, she is 80% more likely to keep her baby. And the story doesn't end there.
My son, Rhett, turned 5 months this week. And even though there are still uncertainties in my life, The one thing I know for sure is I get to watch him grow.
Your gift of $140 will cover the cost of 5 ultrasounds. All donations are tax deductible. You can help save a baby's life right here in America by donating to Preborn. To donate, dial #250, keyword baby, #250, baby, or donate securely at preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Happy Independence Day. This is Ken Ham inviting you to visit our full-size Noah's Ark attraction in Northern Kentucky. Today in America, we celebrate our nation and the many freedoms we enjoy here. But even as we celebrate our freedom, we know that anti-Christian intolerance is growing. Christians who think biblically about origins, marriage, and the sanctity of life are increasingly being punished for their beliefs. More people are beginning to think that religious freedom means you can believe what you want inside a church, but you can't practice it at your job or in public. This isn't true freedom. As Christians are faced with growing intolerance, we need to stand more boldly on our unchanging foundation, God's Word. Human reasoning comes and goes, but God's Word stands forever.
Plan your family's visit to our two world-class attractions, the Creation Museum and the Ark Encounter, at AnswersRadio.com. Learn more when you visit us at AnswersRadio.com.
Back on Janet Mefford today. My guest is Hetty Britz, speaker and author, mother of three, and author of Growing Kids with Character. It's such a daunting task, I think, and all of us want our kids to have godly character, but it really comes down to understanding that kids are different. They have different personalities, different temperaments. We all know this just instinctively if we have children, and Hetty is explaining for us how it is we can better understand our kids. You were talking about the boxwood tree. You have this tall tree profile system that you have come up with, which I think is quite interesting. These are the fine tuners, as you say. These are the quiet ones, the quiet children who tend to be more sensitive.
Yes, they definitely are. And they are not a disciplinary challenge because they naturally feel where the boundaries are and they want to keep within those boundaries. But they are an emotional challenge because they are so sensitive and because they tend to feel and notice the negative before they see the positive in the situation. But they are so by the book that when God gives you one of these as your first baby, you usually think, man, what's everybody else complaining about? This is easy.
Yeah.
Just keep in mind that it's Boxwood
right. Who
wrote those books. Yes, of course it works for your boxwood child. But then there is another quiet tree type, the fourth tree type, and that's the pine tree. Now, when you smell the pine tree fragrance in your nostrils, everything goes into peace mode on the inside, and that's what these kids have, just this calmness. They love the harmony in the home. They are not as emotional. They're more reserved. They're very content. But it's a relational challenge. It's difficult to connect with them because they don't speak. You can't read their facial expressions. You need to do 80% of the relationship. And that's what my daughter was, and that's why I didn't connect with her, because she's a pine tree to the core, and she didn't know how to be fast enough and loud enough for me to actually stop and meet her needs. And I just bulldozed all over her because I was a combination of the other three. I'm a rose, palm tree, boxwood all in one. So I was a little loud and a bit much for her. But that pine tree has such a gift to the Western world because they are the kids who challenge the whole idea of I need to be first, I need to win, I need to participate in everything, I need to make money. Very rarely are any of those goals important to a pine.
Now, this is interesting when you talk about that sort of child. And it's not just the fact that the child is very quiet and you need to be doing most of the work in the relationship, but also the contrast between your personality and your daughter's personality. How do you bridge that gap? You're trying to raise this child to love the Lord and to have godly character. What sort of mothering techniques work with that sort of a child, especially if you have an opposite sort of personality?
Well, we start by acknowledging that every human being has the image of God in them. That means there are characteristics there that are important to him and that are valuable and that should be celebrated. So we dig into their personality. We learn what the wonderful redeeming characteristics are. And we look at the Bible figures who are like our child. And we see how God spoke to them and what he did with them and through them in the world. And that changes the whole perspective, because no longer do I want her to be like me. I now want her to be like every other spirit-filled pine tree that God sent into the world to make a difference. And she's a lot like Abraham. So now I know. How did God speak to Abraham? Well, he sat down with him. He ate with him. He spoke to him about family and about the future and about trust and faith. And those are the things that resonate with this personality. And the others are different, and they need to be spoken to in different ways. And
yes.
Their giftings in God must be activated in different ways.
Right. Now, for parenting in general, one of the verses, and I know you talk about this in the book, everybody will think of Proverbs 22:6, train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it. But what do you glean from that verse in general about what parenting entails? In other words, as a Christian parent, what is your job and what should that look like in the lives of your kids?
Each child has what looks like and acts like a compass needle. They have something that God himself put in them that draws them in a particular direction, that shows the path that they will go on. And we are, as parents, supposed to help discern that direction that God is taking our kids into. And he's given them a temperament as that compass needle. We see it when the kids are on the playground. There's the child who wants to climb the highest he possibly can, as fast as he can. And then there's the child waiting at the bottom in case somebody gets hurt to care for them. Those are all purpose clues of how God is going to use our kids in the world. And we are supposed to go operate with that. Because the moment we step in there and say, I don't want you to be like that. I want you to be more outgoing, be more assertive. Don't be such a goody-two-shoes. Don't take care of everybody. Let people take care of you. You know, be number one. We are not just messing with their idea of what is a valuable human being, but we're also messing with that magnetism that's in them. And when we do that, we get kids who lose their way. And this scripture tells us, if you train up a child according to his way, and by the way, if one does a Bible study about the root words there, it does not talk about God's way, it talks about the child's way. If we train up a child according to the way, the bent that God has put into them, they don't become lost in life. I call it drunk in life. And we know drunk people in life. And it is nothing to do with intoxication. It's about not knowing who you want to be, where God wants you, why you are here. And that happens when people are not allowed to be who God has designed them to be.
That's good. Right. So you don't have a one size fits all approach to each child when
No.
the children are so different. It doesn't work anyway. I mean, that's the funny thing about it. Even if you try to treat them all identically, you can't, because they're not. It just doesn't work. And you discover that pretty quickly, don't you?
Yes. And you have raised four kids.
Yes.
You will be able to write the book yourself.
Well, I'm seeing my children in these profiles that you're mentioning. I wouldn't say their names or anything, but yeah, absolutely. I can relate very, very strongly to your description of different personalities. One of the things, Heidi, that I like that you said in the book was that no technique, strategy, or profile can help you discipline your child if your heart is not with your child. What are you talking about there? What is the takeaway from that particular line?
We just naturally like certain personalities more than we like others. But God does not do that. He loves us all the same. And when our heart can embrace our child for who they are, and when we can believe that God made them this way because he wants them this way, and our child knows that they are loved for who they are, then discipline is easy and then their heart responds to us. And if our heart is turned away because we want them to be different, we want them to be more like us, or we don't like the characteristics that are in our core, they do not feel adopted and in love. And then discipline bounces off a child like that. It does not go into their heart.
Right, right. How do you keep your focus as a mom when you are looking at that end goal? You're wanting your children to follow the Lord. You want them to have godly character. How do you get through the day and how do you keep that long-term goal in mind as you're going through the day-to-day frustrations?
I don't always do that well.
An honest woman.
Well, yes, we are in the trenches together and we mess it up, but at least I know how to apologize.
Good.
I know what it is that I did wrong. I know whether it was too much pressure or too little time or too little fun or at least I know what it is that I did not give this job because I know what their core needs are. And then I can apologize. But I have to add a disclaimer here and say our task is not to always make them perfectly happy because the world will not do that for them.
Right.
So if we just say, okay, let me memorize the needs of a pine tree and we 100% provide that all of the time, we are setting them up for major pain in the world. So God also puts me as a rose bush style personality in my pine tree daughter's life to prepare her for the other thorny people she's going to meet down the pike.
Yes.
So in this friction that exists between opposite sides, there's also a lot of shaping, and it's necessary and it's good. So it's okay if they cry occasionally, but what we are not allowed to do is to dismiss their design because it is God-given.
Yes, that's very well said. And I really appreciate that you say your relationship with the Lord forms the basis for all your relationships. And it is so important for mom to remember to keep your relationship with the Lord on track. So that affects your children in turn, regardless of what their personality is. Well, the name of the book is Growing Kids with Character. Hetty Britt's with us, sharing her thoughts and wisdom on parenting. And we so appreciate your being with us, Hetty. Thank you so much.
I appreciate this, Jenna. Thank you so much.
God bless you, and thanks again for being with us. And thank you for joining us here on Janet Mefford Today. We'll see you next time. God bless.